So I want to say something about respect. Because we're going to be doing a lot of these little exercises, I'd like to suggest that we hold whatever comes up in these discussions, these dialogues, with a care for privacy. So that when we leave today, whenever you leave today, that it doesn't go out into the community, hey, you know, Melanie said this, or Diane said that. That we hold what's being offered to one another in a way that can allow for some intimacy of whatever it is that you want to share without feeling like it's going to be spread out into the wider space and community. So if we can all hold it in that context, I think it would be beneficial. So I'm going to ask us to do another exercise, and this is a little bit of looking at what we perhaps don't see. Sometimes we navigate our world in, it's kind of like you know, swimming in the water and not seeing the water that we swim in. So this next exercise is hopefully a way of seeing maybe what we don't see because of our privilege or because of our identity. And so I'm going to ask you to find a different partner. And try to find somebody of a different gender, if possible. And if you don't have a partner, there's a person who's looking. Right. And maybe to frame how we do these finding partners in a way of holding that with compassion as well. Sometimes what happens is that some people are more reluctant to, or maybe shy perhaps, about finding a partner. And sometimes there can be a sense of not feeling like they belong because nobody picked me, right? We've all had that fear or that experience from our childhood, at least. I think I have, some of us have, in being picked for a team or being picked for something. So see if we can hold the finding partners also with some compassion. If you see somebody that's kind of looking, grab them and be generous and share yourself with them. So here's the question that I'd like you to explore. And I think this time we're going to do it as a series of repeating questions. So one person will take the role of asking the question and the other person will take the role of answering. And we'll do that maybe for about 2 minutes or 3 minutes and then we'll switch. So the question is a little bit complicated, so I'll try to say it a couple times so you get the question down. And the idea is try not to change the question too much. Try to stay with the same question. Even though you're going to be saying it over and over again, it's okay. You're just doing it for the purpose of the other person to explore. And for the person answering the question, it's not so much about giving a reason as just giving the answer as a way of putting it out. It's a little bit like putting it on paper and you get to see it for yourself. So it's not so much for explaining for the person asking the question. It's just to put that out there so that you see it as you speak it and then to keep going through and exploring more and more of these over and over again. Does that make sense? So here's the question. We're going to look at oh, I'll do it backwards. Sorry. I got ahead of myself. We're going to do that in a second. So this one's going to be more of just trading back and forth like we did before. Sorry.
So, Lori, this, what you just described, is going to be the second.
It'll be the second portion of this. So the first portion is going to be, you're just going to go back and forth. So here's the first question. Where do you feel safe? Or where do you not experience fear because of your economic status, your gender identity, your race, or even your beliefs? Like maybe as a Buddhist or whatever that might be, or maybe as a liberal or a conservative. I want to also name that, you know, there might be conservatives in this room as well. And how do we hold them with that kind of similar thing? Like maybe, I had a person who came to my Sangha who was a very staunch conservative person, and he admitted to me at first when he came, he said, I feel like I'm in the enemy camp. And I really made it very clear that he was welcome. And by the time he left, he was like, I actually feel like I'm okay here. And it was okay for me to be here. So to explore the question of where do you feel safe and without fear? What are those places? And share them. So you'll trade back and forth for a couple minutes. And then we'll explore the flip question of where do you feel afraid or where do you feel threatened. Okay? So this is just the one of where do you feel safe or where do you not feel fear. So this is not a repeating question. This is just for you to trade back and forth the answers. So try to keep it brief so that your partner can also say where they feel safe, so that you'll have many, many answers within this period of time. So you don't have to explain it. Okay. So stop for a second, maybe take a deep breath or two. Reconnect in your body. So we're going to do a flip here, and the question will be, where do you feel unsafe or fearful? And again, the idea is not to explain why, just name the places. Okay, so just name. Where do you feel fearful or unsafe? Or maybe even that you don't belong. That can be part of that sphere. And so you'll just keep trading off with one another through this period. So you can begin when you're ready. Okay. Thank your partner. You can stay where you are because we're going to do a little bit more, but let me just check in. What came up for you around that, or what did you learn from that exercise? Any comments? Yeah. Yeah, so you're, okay, great. So let me just name that. There's a resonance or there's some empathy that's happening maybe even concern or some emotional affect that's coming up from hearing your partner. Is that correct? And yeah, even connecting with your own fear or, right, okay, great. So this is really important. This is a piece that sometimes we don't acknowledge, is what's happening for us when that's happening. You know, that we can have an emotional response to hearing someone else, and we can also have our own emotional response happening as well. And it's important to recognize, for example, do I need to take care of myself in that moment? Maybe I need to slow down, or maybe I need to stop and breathe, or maybe I need to connect with my body. So this is a part that's really important in compassion practice, because if we don't take care of the emotional response, we can get overwhelmed or flooded. And that's where a lot of people tend to get stuck, is they get overwhelmed by that emotional resonance or that emotional response, and they don't take care of that. So what happens is we suppress it or we squash it. Oh, I need to do, or I need to be here, or I need to do something, and we're not taking care of what's happening for us. So just for a moment, I'd like everyone to take a deep breath in. Let it out through your mouth. Connect to the body that relaxes as you do that. Do that one or two more times at your own pace. And really allow that breath to come out of the mouth, even though we're so trained to just breathe through the nose. Notice what happens in your body as you do that. That there's actually a relaxation response that we're tapping into. Just take a moment to breathe. So it's so helpful to know perhaps how to titrate or how to mitigate or how to moderate how much we take in or how much we can be with, and to actually take steps to allow ourselves to meet what we can. One of the things in, if you ever get a chance, and if he's in your area or if you need to go and find him, listen to or go to a day long with Sean Feet Oakes. He does a lot of work around trauma in spiritual practice. Sean Feet, F-E-I-T, Oakes, O-A-K-E-S. He came to Modesto and did a day long recently, and he was saying that one of the things is that when we get into overwhelm, we can't be present anymore. And so learning how to mitigate or how to know when to interrupt that so that you can be present. In other words, if you force yourself, for example, a lot of times we hear these instructions, just be with your emotions. Sometimes it's too much. We've already flooded. And so how do we actually know at what point is it too much and I need to actually disengage for skillfulness, for taking care of ourselves? Because otherwise, you fill up and then you've triggered the amygdala in the brain into fight or flight or freeze. And it can't be here when that happens. So we actually have to do something useful. And what I'm doing now as I'm talking to you is I'm giving you a little break for the nervous system to relax and settle and come back. And so even just hearing my voice might be a way that you can resettle, or connecting with your body, connecting with the ground beneath you is a way to resettle. Another way that's helpful sometimes is just take a moment and look around the room. See the faces that you know. Maybe even connect to them. knowing that they're friendly faces. No one's going to harm you. And to know that this is a safe space, a friendly space. One of the things that happens in terms of trauma is that we lose ourselves into whatever that thing is that triggered, and we forget that we're here in a safe space, or we forget that the ground is holding us up. We forget that we can come back to our bodies, and this can be a safe place. I'll name that for some people, their bodies aren't a safe place. And so we have to find what is the safe place for you. The safe place might be to look around the room and reassure yourself that you're safe. Or to look around the room and see a familiar face and recognize, oh, I'm safe. Because if there was trauma in the body might not be the place to find safety. So, other comments, other responses. Let me ask a question, and I will be transparent and name it, because I'm making an assumption. But how many of you, in terms of naming places that were unsafe, how many of you named, specific places or times of day? Okay. Because sometimes what comes out of that is that, for example, women in particular have to be more aware of places that they go and times of day that they can be in certain places than men. And this is a place that we can sometimes have blindness about, particularly for the men, to not see that you might be able to go places that women can't without fear. Right? Or, for example, if you're a white person, that you might be able to go places that a person of color might not be able to go without fear. Or maybe economic status. There are places that you might not be able to go that other people might be able to go. So this is a place to explore in terms of what are we unaware of? What do we not see? So in our group last year, we had a White Awake program that was offered. And so we got questions, which was really great, of people going, well, why is it just for only white people? And I got to use an example and say, well, if we had a mixed group, first of all, for people of color, it might be very painful to recount their experiences. And it would be as if, for example, right now we have men and women in the room, and it would be like for this mixed group to explore what it's like to experience sexual harassment, the women in the group that might be asked to share that might be re-traumatized by having to share that experience. And maybe the men in the group might feel awkward about asking questions because they might not know if they're going to cause harm in asking a question. So the idea of having a white awake group for people who identify as white allows them to make all those faux pas without feeling terrible that, oh, they've offended somebody, and also to feel safe in really exploring territory that might be painful. And it can be explored in a safe place or as safe a place as we can make it, right? Without re-traumatizing people of color, or, for example, not re-traumatizing women who have had experiences of sexual harassment, of having to explain what happened to them. But instead, for these individual groups, these affinity groups, as you might call them, to have more freedom of exploring without the fear of more harm. Does that make sense? But it's helpful to ask the questions. Where can I go that I don't see my privilege? Or where can other people not go because they don't have that ability or privilege? So in the context of what Sean likes to teach, and I thought it was really provocative but interesting, is he likes to say that privilege is at one end and trauma is at the other of a spectrum. And that trauma, sometimes we like to think of it as a one-time big event, but that we can be traumatized by cumulative stress, cumulative stressors that result in trauma. So, for example, for somebody who is African-American, turns out there are studies that show that African-American women have a higher fatality in birth, of giving birth. And they tried to actually tease out, well, why is that? They were thinking, well, they're not getting as good a care or whatever else. But it turns out that it has to do with everyday stress of being black in America. And it turns out that women who come from Africa, who have not been in the United States for very long, don't have the same mortality rates. But if they've been here for a while, their mortality rates go up because there's a constant stress of being fearful of being in some way attacked because they're black. And it results in a higher mortality rate. So it's interesting to recognize how that can play out. And so to pay attention to, in what ways am I not seeing? And so each of us has different places that we have privilege. So it's not just a racial thing. So it's interesting to explore, in what places do you have privilege? And in what places do you experience trauma? And for each of us, that might be different. In what places am I fearful to go? And in what places can I go easily and be welcome? There's a really interesting couple places that I've heard this, but one is about power. That power allows you to belong anywhere. And when you don't have power, you feel that you don't belong, or that you are left out. And in the context of that, the person that said this was out of a podcast from On Being. It was a TED Radio Hour. The person that was speaking said that colonialism comes from this place of power, from this idea that if you have power, you can basically walk in anywhere. You can go anywhere, and basically everything is owned by you. And if you don't have power, then you have no place, right? And
using power in a different way.
Yes. And I want to say that it's not always true, but that power can lead to that mentality of colonialism when we don't see it clearly. Does that make sense? So power can be used positively, but it can also be used negatively. And so when we can see more clearly the places that we have power and the places that we don't, we can be more sensitive, right? So, for example, me sitting up here has a certain amount of power. Even though I might not feel that I am wielding it, all of you will perceive that I'm in a place of power. If I'm not aware of that, I could misabuse it, right? And so it's important for me to be aware of that. In the same way, it's important for all of you, in whatever ways that you experience power or privilege, to be aware of that, so that when you're in a situation, when the dynamic is such that there's a person who doesn't have that power, that you can understand and be sensitive to that. And that's where compassion comes in, because the idea is that in compassion, we have a level playing field. I see you as another human being deserving of kindness and respect. If I see you from an elevated position, that's pity, and that's not compassion. So I have to be careful about where I come from and whether I'm aware of the power dynamic. Yes.
One thing that came out in our exercise was maybe in the question, where do you feel safe?
Mm-hmm.
Some of our answers were, when do you feel safe?
Yeah.
So, for example, as a man...
Thank you, Diane.
I feel safe in many places.
Yeah.
But there are circumstances that challenge me.
Right. Yeah, and I think
that places.
Yeah, that's come out when I've done this exercise in a couple of groups, where men will say it's situational, mm-hmm. but women will say, you know, it's very, very tied to, you know, if I'm alone and it's at night, that's not safe, or, you know, in particular situations, but it's less situational. The men tend to be much more situational based. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So hopefully this one won't be as... This will be challenging in a different way. So this next part of the question, this is the repeating question. So this one is for... what was your name, Ron? No. Tony. This one will be a good one for Tony to explore. So this is the repeating question one. So I'll let you guys decide who's going to be the questioner for the first set and who will be the answerer. The question will be, name a characteristic or behavior of people you strongly dislike that drives you crazy. And then the second half of that question is, have you ever exhibited this characteristic or done that behavior yourself? Does that make sense? So this is to look a little bit at the shadow that we don't usually pay attention to. Hi, Raphael. Welcome. Are you going to join us? You can kind of hang out and watch first if you want. Or, let's see, is somebody willing to pair up with Raphael? Or I'm happy to pair up with you. You want to come and pair up with me, Raphael? Can I get you to come up? We're going to do an exercise, because you walked in just as we're about to start an exercise. Okay, so does everybody kind of have that question? So the question will be, Name a characteristic or behavior of people you strongly dislike and drive you crazy. And then, have you ever exhibited that yourself? And the idea is just to keep naming them. So the person will ask the question, you'll name it, you'll say something about that, and then you'll say thank you. And then the questioner will ask a question again. You'll name another one and just go through as many.
Or the second one, when you do the repeating question, is
have you ever exhibited that yourself?
Yeah.
That's part of the first question. So for example, if I were to ask you that, I would say, Diane, name a characteristic or behavior of some people that you strongly dislike that drives you crazy. Mm-hmm. And then, have you ever experienced that, or have you ever displayed that yourself?
So it's actually two repeating
questions. It's two repeating questions, but they're all rolled together.
Got it.
Yeah. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. Good luck. We're going to do, I'm going to use my phone so that I can do this with Raphael. We'll have, say, 2 minutes to, and then we'll switch. So you can begin. Okay. And it seemed like you got to get a few of those. Okay, so we're going to switch. And so the person that was asking the question will now be the answerer. Oh, sorry. Yes, that's right. Okay, you can begin. Okay. Great. Thank your partner. Anything you want to bring into the large group about that exercise?
Well, I actually, some of them, there's a brief sort of sense that this is something I don't like in an individual because it impedes my sense of well-being. But in fact, it mostly came out because I recognized this in myself.
Yeah.
It was so clear that as I described this nature that I don't care for, that very much is a prominent part of who I am.
Yeah.
Behaviors that I exhibit.
Right.
And so that was very interesting and illuminating and very helpful.
Uh-huh.
Very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes.
I have a question. I know what behaviors in other people upset me, but I don't ever see the same behaviors in myself. So am I oblivious to myself?
I don't know. That might be an interesting inquiry. That would be an interesting inquiry. Maybe ask a few people.
Thank you.
Yeah, sometimes, seeing our blind spots is, maybe I need to ask people too, because sometimes we don't even see them ourselves. Diane, you had something.
Yeah, I was going to say, kind of along the same lines of Jim, unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
but I see where I've been working on areas.
Yeah.
Maybe not as bad as I used to be.
Yeah.
And I dislike it in others, but I also see one of the things was morality. I don't like seeing people who are just immoral and have no concern for others. I was like that once too, but
right.
It's something that I'm constantly working.
Yes, 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 and so it's a spectrum, and part of this is about bringing in wholeness. Often, I know for myself in my own mindfulness practice, is that sometimes I see things that I don't like about myself, and then I try to ignore or deny or pretend they're not there because, as a good Buddhist, I shouldn't be like that, right? The problem about that is that goes underground, or that it sabotages us because we're not aware of it. And part of it is that we have to fold that in as this is me too. I am also this. And it doesn't mean that I am that all the time. again, it comes back to this question, are you who, you know, are you the emotion that you're experiencing? Are you the behavior that you do? And I think the point of this is to see that all of these things, our emotions, the behaviors, some of those are conditioned responses, but they're not necessarily who we are. That if we confuse that, then we can get really wrapped up. But to allow for the whole spectrum of being human, that is, being a human being includes experiencing anger and frustration and irritation and even being cruel at times or being loving at times and being very compassionate and being very caring, but that there's a range, a spectrum. And if we can't allow for all of that to be in the room, then we're actually blind. You know, we're pretending that it's not there. And if we don't see it, then we can't do anything about it. So the important piece is that in order to change, we have to see. In order to do something about what we maybe dislike, we have to see that. But that's also a place where compassion comes in, because we can even see how hard that is to be that good person, or how hard it is to maybe not be that angry, self-righteous, cruel person. That, oh, yeah, I'm that too. So now I can actually extend compassion, because I know that that's a difficult thing in myself that I dislike. I want to read a quote. This is from Carl Jung, believe it or not. The acceptance of oneself is the essence of the whole moral problem and the epitome of a whole outlook on life. That I feed the hungry, that I forgive an insult, that I love my enemy, all these are undoubtedly great virtues. But what if I should discover that the least among them all, the poorest of all the beggars, the most impudent of all offenders, the very enemy himself, that these are within me, and that I myself stand in need of the alms of my own kindness, that I am myself, that I myself am the enemy who must be loved, what then? And, you know, this is one of the places that self-compassion comes in, because we often turn to what we don't like and then we project it out into the world, or we see it out in the world and we rant and rave about that, and yet we haven't actually taken this enemy inside in account and been kind to that. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn says, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? So this is a place of recognition, of seeing ourselves in both the good and the bad, it's messy in here. You know, it's not all perfect and peace and light, even though we would like it to be. And when we see how messy it is, we can be more forgiving of ourselves and of others. I want to read one more piece, and then I want to do a little introduction into forgiveness, because forgiveness is a big piece that is necessary for us to move into this transformation of suffering into compassion. This is by Jeff Foster. I find truth in anything anyone ever says about me, so nobody can be my enemy. Call me a fraud, I can find it. Call me a liar, I can find it. Call me a failure, I can find it. Call me unreasonable, irresponsible, ignorant, deluded, full of ego, totally unenlightened, the worst being in the world, I can find all of it. As consciousness, I can find anything. Like you, I have nothing to hide, nothing to lose, and no image to protect. Every possible facet of human experience is available here. This is truly the end of war. It is the end of protecting and defending a mirage called me. So next time you get triggered by something someone says to you or about you, ask yourself this: what am I defending? This inquiry is the key to unimaginable peace. So I want to start a little bit of an inquiry into forgiveness. Because I think that's the thing that allows us to be here. Sometimes even in our own practice, in our own meditation, we need some forgiveness. The times that our mind sweeps us away and we're lost, and we come back and we berate ourselves for being lost. Or we think, oh, I'm not a good meditator. I'm never going to be a good meditator. The forgiveness is the piece that helps us to come back. It helps us to start again. The heart helps us to start with a clean slate. So here's my question to you. And we'll do a couple of these questions. Maybe for you to just reflect on. Who benefits from forgiveness? Who is the beneficiary? Should I read these? I'll keep reading and then we'll... Is forgiveness the same as reconciliation? And if not, what's the difference? Are there times you've been unable to forgive? And if so, has holding on to unforgiveness worked for you? If it was a strategy to achieve something, has it worked for you, unforgiveness? I'll ask the first question and see if anybody wants to answer. Who benefits from forgiveness?
The self.
The self? Mm-hmm.
Everybody?
Possibly. But maybe... maybe it doesn't have to be. Yeah. Good.
The Jewish faith is that until you've forgiven someone else, you are allowing them to live rent free in your head.
Yeah. 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 So, you know, that last question about has unforgiveness been a good strategy for you? What is it like when you can't forgive, in terms of, do you feel that it harms you? Because maybe that person cut you off on the road, here on your way. That person's long gone. They probably don't even know they did it to you. But your recollection of it, your memory of it, causes you harm. So, maybe. The question is, does it help you achieve something? Suffering? So how does that help you? Yeah.
I have experienced in the past maybe a rush of, you know, this is absolutely unacceptable and I have to do something about it. So it's almost anger to fuel, but it doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
An abrasiveness, a causticity, a tightening, a clenching, a force that lives in the body, I think, to some degree.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't need to carry that.
Yeah.
Because, and so mostly we need to forgive to heal ourselves.
Yeah.
But also to heal the other, because it's, you know, it's just, we're wasting time to harbor that stuff. It's hard. It's hard to let it go.
Right, right. So it's important to recognize that forgiveness is a process, and it's not something that you're going to go flip the switch and it's done. But to recognize also that it's a self-inflicted pain. It's self-inflicted every time that you recollect that. And so in a way, the forgiveness process is to recognize that it's not about condoning behavior in any way, but it's about your letting that, or no longer letting that continue to create pain for you. And that's the piece of forgiveness that allows you to move forward. there's a phrase that's often misattributed to Jack Kornfield, and I think it was Michelle McDonald that actually came up with the phrase, but it's a phrase about forgiveness is giving up all hope of a happy past. I saw something just recently that added a little corollary to it, and it's giving up all hope of a happy past and the ability to change something in the future. Because as long as you're tied to the past and you're still hoping for a happy past, you can't actually move into the future, or rather the opportunity of something happening differently in the future is blocked. And that when you can actually let go of having that happy past, you can actually move into a different way into the future. So I'm just kind of planting little seeds here, not in the sense of saying I'm very careful about not shooting on anybody. Forgiveness is not a should, but forgiveness is something of a process. But to start to see where we get held back because we're holding on to unforgiveness or holding on to resentment, that, you know, I think it's in the Buddha's teachings where he actually uses the analogy of holding a piece of coal. Yeah.
The poison that everybody talks about.
Yeah, drinking the poison and expecting the other person to die.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we're the one that suffers from the poison. And so we have to actually see that, see the truth of that in a way that starts to allow us to soften the bond, or to loosen the bond of that. I think all of you probably have gotten exposure to the nuns, Ayasanta Chitta and Ayananda Bodhi. And I remember, I think it was on a New Year's retreat, that he talked about the idea of when we hold on to resentment or things that we're unable to forgive, it's as if we have a string back to the past, or a string attached to that person, a string that's tied to us. And if you could imagine walking around your life with all these things attached to you that are tugging at you in all these different directions that are tied to the person that you dislike or that you had a bad experience with, I don't think I want to be dragging them along with me. I actually think I want to cut those strings and let them go. So I just want to name this before we go into our lunch and into the afternoon, because the afternoon we'll look at, we're going to look a little bit at blame and shame and forgiveness in terms of ways to move forward and to meet the suffering that is not only in us but in the world. And I think without the tool of forgiveness, it's a harsh place. It's really hard because we want to hold to certain views or certain ideas about the way we want the world to be. Yes?
I'm confused. Maybe you could clarify this. Maybe
yeah.
Some others would benefit. In forgiveness, there is a forgiver and a forgivee. Could you talk about the two differences? Because I'm clear about that. I've heard a lot of talk. And we're talking about forgiveness. Well, what about, I'm asking somebody, would you please forgive me? And that person is then saying yes or no.
Oh, so in the context that I'm talking about forgiveness, mm-hmm. we don't need the permission of anybody. It's what we're doing in our own heart. So I'm actually talking about freeing our own heart. Mm-hmm. Think of your heart being wrapped up and bundled up and chained down by all the hurts and harms and things that we remember. And no one can unleash that heart but us.
I don't understand. Maybe I'm just dead. And I don't know if anyone else doesn't understand and is too embarrassed to say it.
Well, here's a question for you.
Okay.
If you want to change, who does that change?
I do.
Right? If you want someone else to change, do you think you can actually make them change if they don't want to change? Right? So how does your changing your heart have to do with anyone else but you? If you're waiting for somebody to give you permission to open your heart, you're going to wait a long time. You have to allow that for yourself. If you're asking for somebody to release your heart, they don't have it under lock and key, you do. I think there's a Rumi poem, something or other, about you're in a prison and the key is right there. You just have to reach it and open the door. You keep waiting for the jailer to come by and let you go. But the key is there. And that's what forgiveness is about. The key is under your control. You have the key. You have to just open it. But a lot of times we want to hold ourselves hostage because it feels good to blame somebody else. It's your fault. It's your fault that I'm miserable. But the Buddha would say, pay attention to the thoughts in your mind. Who's thinking those thoughts? And are those thoughts real? Are they true? Remember, we started with the distortions of thought and mind and perception and view. we get to choose whether we believe them or not. Do I want to believe that thought? Do I want to give that thought power? You have the power, you have the ability to say, I'm going to give that thought power over me, or not. That's the benefit. Yes?
Is it a blind spot thing? Because the mind can't really forgive, or at least that's been my experience. The mind can't do it. It's some place else that actually lets go.
I think it's a set of conditions. So, you know, just like everything else, it's interesting. We don't really have control. We get to see that every time we sit down and meditate and we tell our mind, stay here, and it doesn't, right? But we can set the conditions up. We can create the conditions for the mind to stay. We can set the conditions for the mind to be trained. We can set the conditions, just like, you know, we're products of habit over time. We can keep setting new conditions. We change the conditions. So when we talk about forgiveness, for example, maybe that starts to plant the seed. That's why I said I'm planting seeds. And if you give the seed a little water, or if there's fertile soil, the seed will grow, right? We can't, like, make it happen. You know, you can't make forgiveness happen in the sense that, oh, I should stop forgiving that person for harming me years ago. If I'm not ready, that's not going to let go, right? It's very similar to what we talk about in letting go in our practice. Letting go is not a thing that we do. If you think that, you'll cause yourself a lot of suffering. Because you'll say, I should let go, I ought to let go, and all the shoulding happens, and it's just really painful. The letting go is actually a release. It's a release because you find that it's no longer serving you. And it's not cognitive, it's that you keep seeing it enough times that the mind just says, I don't want to do that anymore. That hurts so much. Why? Right? And so the release is a natural response, as opposed to one that we make. I'm gonna force my hand to open because I've been told it's better to have an open hand. But if my hand doesn't want to open, I'm just causing myself a lot of pain. But if I put my attention in my hand and I notice my hand is really clenched and I start to pay attention to it, I go, oh, that really hurts. It would actually feel better if I release some of the tension. And so what happens is that happens naturally, as opposed to me saying, I have to make it happen. Does that make sense? It's kind of inside out. So it's not a top down, it's from the bottom up. And that's where the forgiveness comes. It's not something that we make happen. And maybe that's an answer to your question. It's not something that we can make happen or that we can force. It's something that we start to loosen the bonds of it. And eventually what happens is those bonds fall away and suddenly it's no longer something that's binding us anymore. That's where the freedom comes, is suddenly we're not attached to that memory in the same way that we were before. So this is a good place to maybe stop and have lunch, and then we'll come back and we'll look a little bit more at just kind of how we get sidetracked into blame and into shame. And then we'll talk a little bit more about stepping into the empathy piece and how to use that wisely in a way that doesn't overwhelm, and how that can help us transform, or how to get out of the helplessness piece, because that's a place that is just really so debilitating when we feel that we can't do anything and we give up. We go into a place of apathy. So how do we transform that in a positive way? And that's kind of where we'll end the day. So hopefully it'll be an up note. We're trending upwards. So thank you. Have a great lunch. We'll be back.